From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. Well, it was a fairly wet February and a very wet March, Chris.
Yes.
And just how much? Well, we're going to get the update on our snow and water conditions this morning from Jordan Clayton, who is the Utah Snow Survey Supervisor. He's going to give us a summary on how this winter unfolded and some insight into what it means going into spring.
That's right. Then in the second part of the show, author, attorney, and environmental historian Lowell Bear will discuss his new book, Earth's Emergency Room, Saving Species as the Planet and Politics Get Hotter. In the book, Bear covers the last 50 years of the Endangered Species Act of 1973 and profiles his work with the ESA from its inception to the present, along with key figures who shaped its history, from field biologists to senators and presidents. Now, the ESA is one of our most cherished and, as Lowell describes, reviled laws. It mandates protection and preservation of all the nation's species and biodiversity, whatever the cost. It has been a lightning rod for controversy and conflicts between capitalism and conservation. Lowell Bear and his book, Earth's Emergency Room, in the second part of the show. And environmental awareness, okay, and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us. Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley.
And joining us for the first part of the show is Jordan Clayton. He is the Utah Snow Survey Supervisor, among other things. And he's here. He joins us every few months or so
That's
to
right.
give us an update on all things snow and precipitation in general. And what kind of impacts that's having on our ecosystems and streams and creeks and reservoirs, et cetera. Jordan, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Good morning. Thank you again for having me on.
Okay. So climatological winter ended the end of February. Is that right? Climatological winter is the months of December, January, and February?
Yeah, I believe so. Although we definitely conclude March and April as sort of core winter months for our mountain snowpack.
Yeah, that's true. So let's take a look at that first. How did things generally go with respect to this winter snowfall and precipitation wise?
Yeah, it's been really positive. I think probably the listeners are aware that we've had good snowpack conditions, but exactly how good, I think, is an interesting question. We're statewide at about 130% of normal for our snow water equivalent. That's the key parameter that we look at. That's how much water is stored in our snowpack. You can look at snow depth and other things as well for recreation. That's obviously quite meaningful to see how deep your snowpack is. But from a water supply perspective, we really focus on the snow water equivalent. So we call that SWE for that SWE, snow water equivalent. And like I say, we're about 130% of normal right now. The last time we had, for the state of Utah, back-to-back years this much above normal was 2005 and 2006. Hmm. So it's really been a long time since we've seen a couple winters in a row really boost the state's water supply. And the last couple of months in particular have been really good. Both February and March gave us well above normal snowpack conditions compared to the last 30 years or the whole period of record or whatever you want to compare it to. So we're not breaking records like last year, but we're definitely enjoying another above normal snowpack season.
And how is normal defined again? What's the time period associated with developing a normal number?
Yeah, good question. So we typically compare to the previous 30-year window. So we're looking at 1991 to 2020 in that 30-year window comparison. We've talked about this on the show before, the transition from the 1981 mm-hmm. to 2010, you know, 30 years versus this 30 years. And there are some kind of interesting tidbits about that transition, but by and large, we're looking at kind of similar, quote unquote, normals in each of those 30-year windows. And again, this winter season compares favorably to really either one of those windows. We can also look at the whole what we call period of record, which is from the very beginning of when we put in these snowtell weather stations in Utah's mountains in the late 1970s until the present. And by any of those metrics, we've had two really great winters in a row.
And just in case our listeners don't know what a snowtell is, can you tell them what that is?
Yeah, thanks for that. I sometimes forget that not everybody lives in snowtell world like I do. The snowtell sites are our weather stations that we have in Utah's mountains and really throughout the western United States. They're weather stations that are specifically designed to measure snowpack conditions and the water equivalent of the snowpack and some other key things. So every one of our sites, we have 138 sites in Utah alone, and every one of those has the following. It has a snow pillow that measures the water equivalent of the snowpack. It has a snow depth sensor so you can see how deep the snowpack is. From those two things, you can get the density of the snow. We also have a precipitation gauge that'll tell us both rainfall and snow that's accumulated. So that's good for the summer and the winter seasons. We have air temperature, and we also have three soil moisture sensors in the ground at 2 inches down, 8 inches down, and 20 inches down. And so that really gives us a nice suite of parameters that we can look at to see how things are going in the mountains, not just in the winter, but also in the summer. And we have a few sites that have some additional sensors, but that's really the main sensor suite that we have at most of our sites.
And I'm curious, because you have been tracking this for so many years, and I'm sure that our technology has increased, when you base it on 30 years ago, how were we tracking then?
Yeah, that's interesting. So a couple of different ways to approach that. We definitely had fewer sites in our network. So what we would consider normal was based on a smaller sample size in terms of the number of sites we could compare it to. And it was also based on a smaller sample size just because there was less years in the period of record. We're up to 114 sites right now that we use when we make a quote normal for the state of Utah. And the reason why we don't use all 138 is that they have to be more than 10 years old to be included. And so we have got a whole bunch of sites that just missed the cutoff. We built a lot of sites in 2012, actually, and they just missed the cutoff for that most recent 30-year window transition. So they'll get included in 2031 when we transition to the next 30-year period.
Where are there snowtell sites, say, here in Summit County?
Yeah, in Summit County, we've got a couple. There's one on in kind of the back part of Park City's ski resort called Thanes Canyon.
Right.
We've also got, I'm going to zoom in so I don't miss anything. We've got sites that are being considered. There's a new site that's being considered that would be just above Jordanelle Reservoir. That's one that has not been built yet, but it's being looked at as a possible addition to our network. And then on the other side of the divide, we've got them in Little and Big Cottonwood Canyons, both at Brighton, Mildee, Snowbird, Atwater, the top of Parley's Canyon, one that's, it's really in the top of Lamb's Canyon. It's called Parley's Upper, but it's really the top of Lamb's Canyon. So we've got several that are close to Park City, but Thanes Canyon is really the only one that's strictly in the same watershed.
Do ski resorts or say municipalities or so participate in collecting data too, either for their own use or do they share that data with you?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So we definitely appreciate the assistance, really significant assistance that we get from Salt Lake City Public Utilities, particularly John Wells' team there, who helps us measure snow courses. And they have a lot of their own operational needs for that snow information in terms of how they manage some of the reservoirs in their system, those kinds of things. And then, of course, the ski resorts do their own snow studies and they have their own snowpack measurements. But one thing I should mention about the ski resorts is they typically will measure snowfall during storms, which is very useful because it allows, you know, people that want to come recreate there to understand how much new accumulation's been there. But a little bit less common is for them to report the snow depth in the same way that we do, where our snow depth sensors are looking at the actual thickness of the snowpack above the ground at that point, which is a little different because it includes all the compaction that's happened through the winter. So let's say you get 20 inches of snow on Friday. By Sunday, it's probably compacted down to maybe 15 or 13 inches of snow, depending on how light and kind of airy the snow was. And so we're looking at that 13 number, and the resorts a lot of times will look at that 20-inch number because, again, they're looking at how much new snow fell when it was in its most powdery, if you will, form.
Yeah, and I guess it's safe to say that, let's say, a 20-inch snowfall during a weekend in the middle of March may be different in its characteristics from a 20-inch snowfall during a weekend in, say, December or January.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You tend to get more density in your snow later in the season. So the colder the air typically will give you the lighter the density, meaning that there's less water content for the same volume of snow. So when we talk about Utah's really light, powdery snow, we're typically talking about snowfall densities that are in the range of 5% to maybe 8%. So it's really, really lightweight, very, very small amount of water content in that snowpack, snowfall, I should say, when it's coming down. In the spring, you're typically much higher density. You could be 10% or more, mm-hmm. and it maybe has some rain mixed in, so it could be a lot higher than that. And so it's quite common to see additions to our snowpack this time of year that don't actually add much to our snow depth, which is a little counterintuitive. You think like, hey, I'm getting new snow. How much new snow did I get? Well, I only got like an inch, but actually you might have gotten a lot of water content added in that spring event, even if it didn't add a lot of snow depth to your snowpack.
And right. And add to that the fact that obviously this time of year when we get a snowfall event, we could get 4 or 5 inches in a few hours, but once the sun comes out, it can be gone within 30 minutes or so. The melt is rapid.
Yeah, so that's another, I love coming on this green earth because you ask such good questions. It's one of the things that we look at in terms of the snowpack density, not just the new snow, but the whole snowpack,
right,
is how close it is to what we call ripe. So when we get conditions where the density of that snowpack is pushing 45-ish percent, maybe even 50%, and the temperature profile of that snowpack is typically where we have basically one temperature at the top. It's the same as the temperature at the bottom of the snowpack. That is a really strong indication to us that that snowpack is ready to melt. And therefore, it means that just a little bit more energy in terms of the solar input, or if there's warm temperatures in the air, just a little bit more energy that's added to that snowpack will allow it to start to transition to the melt phase. And that's exactly what happens, is what you said. Now we're suddenly producing runoff instead of, you know, just freezing that water internally inside the snowpack.
Which is not a bad thing, per se. And we'll get to that. But let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Jordan Clayton. He is the Utah Snow Survey Supervisor, and we're talking about, well, all things snow and precipitation and now runoff. So here we are. It's the beginning of April. Obviously up here at 7, 8, 9,000 feet, you know, we're still susceptible to snowfall. I think we're going to have a storm in the next few days. We're checking on that now. During the weekend or so, another some more snow then, snow, rain, et cetera. But now runoff season is going to start. And how are streams and rivers and lakes looking?
Right. This is the key question. This is why we're so interested in quantifying the snowpack, is that we get about 95% of our water in the state of Utah from our seasonal snowpack. And that proportion is a little bit lower in the southwest corner of the state, but by and large, really the vast majority of our water comes from our snowpack. So we obviously need to be able to quantify how much water is stored up in our mountains. And we're looking really good. Right now, our reservoir system is in outstanding shape. We're statewide, and I should mention before I get into too many details here, these are numbers that were current at the beginning of March, because we're in the process today and tomorrow of generating new numbers. This is kind of an interesting time because we do these reports at the beginning of March, beginning of April, that kind of thing, and we don't have the updated numbers just yet. So I am talking about numbers that are slightly outdated, but I can talk about some things that might be different. Anyway, as of about a month ago, the reservoir system in the state of Utah was about 82% full. which is really outstanding. And it means that most of our reservoirs, in fact, almost all of them, will fill up from this season's runoff. A couple of them probably won't. Yuba Lake, which is otherwise known as Sevier Bridge, probably will not fill up. Obviously, our really massive water bodies like Lake Powell isn't going to come anywhere close to filling up. The Great Salt Lake is going to get a boost, but it's not going to, of course, fill up, depending on what you call filling up for that water body.
Right.
So there's definitely a lot of need for the water. But in terms of most of our reservoir storage in the state of Utah, it's gonna fill, and we're already in very good shape. There's going to be a lot of potential for extra water to pass through those reservoirs and make it downstream. In terms of the forecast, we're looking at really encouraging forecasts, particularly in northern Utah, the Weber Basin, the Bear River Basin, the Six Creeks area. Those are all looking at above normal forecasts. Time will tell a little bit for southern Utah. The forecasts that we issued in early March were a little bit on the pessimistic side, particularly for the Sevier River Basin. I'm wondering if those will get a little bit more optimistic now that we've seen above normal snowpack conditions for the month of March. Those improvements will be taken into account. So I'm expecting the corresponding increase in our forecast as well.
And obviously this also benefits another key characteristic or parameter you watch, and that's soil moisture content. Talk about what that is and why that's important.
Yeah, that's definitely become one of the key things that we look at. The soil moisture, I should start with just saying that the soil moisture across the state of Utah, if we combine all of it into one value, we're very close to normal for this time of year. We've been a little bit above normal for a while, and normal is kind of catching up right now, and that's actually not a bad thing. All that means is that in many years, we would already be in the melt phase right now, and so the soil moisture would be increasing. Hmm. But because we have an above normal snowpack season this time, we're not quite as far along into our melt cycle. So therefore, there's not as much water in the soil compared to kind of the typical snowpack season.
No.
But it'll catch up here in probably a couple of weeks. And so long story short, maybe it's too late for that. But long story short, we really are encouraged by our soil moisture conditions. And the reason why that matters is if we have wet basins, if the soils are wet in the headwaters of Utah's mountains, that just means that a much larger proportion of that snow melt is going to make it downstream. What happened a few winters ago is that the opposite happened. We had historically dry soils underneath that snowpack. This was the winter of 21. And so much of that snow water just got it kept up in those headwaters. It was soaked up like a sponge, and a large proportion of it didn't make it downstream. And it was really a catastrophically poor runoff season. And we're not seeing anything like that we have to be concerned about in the state of Utah right now. Things are a little bit drier in the mountains in southeastern Utah, so it's a little bit less positive there. But by and large, soil moisture conditions are looking good.
But we were working at such a deficit, and now it feels like these last 2 years we kept talking about how dire it was. I remember having you on the show, but it feels like you said we're working our way back to normal. And we've had two great years. But what happens if we have another great year, Are we going to continue to see, like, the Great Salt Lake be affected by this? And do you have a projection for what it's going to look like?
Yeah, it's kind of the money question. People have been very curious about how the Great Salt Lake is going to respond since now we're looking at a back-to-back above normal snowpack years. And we are trying to forecast how much the lake is going to rise. It's included in our water supply outlook reports that come out each month. And we will have a new forecast for that in a couple of days here. Those forecasts, I should say at the outset, are very, very, they're not wild guesses. They are model results, but there's a lot of uncertainty. And I don't know how much we need to get into the details of why there's so much uncertainty there, but it's a very hard prediction point. That being said, the beginning of March, we were estimating between about a half a foot and almost 2 feet of lake level rise from the beginning of March to when it peaks. Now, obviously, we're not at the beginning of March anymore, and the lake has been creeping up. So the new forecast will be from the beginning of April until when the lake peaks. And I guess we'll see what that forecast number looks like. The median value in there was about 1.2 feet. But part of why this is an interesting challenge right now is that, as I was mentioning, the reservoir system is pretty full. And that's true also for the reservoirs that are upstream from the Great Salt Lake. And that just means that a lot less of the water that's coming off the mountains from our snowpack is going to need to be stored in those reservoirs that are upstream from the Great Salt Lake. So a larger proportion of that water can make it downstream. And the state is working hard to ensure that water is delivered to the Great Salt Lake. And so we're watching this. We're aware that there's a lot of management decisions that go into these, inflows. And so we'll just see how it pans out. But I'm encouraged because of the great snowpack conditions that we'll be looking at additional gains in the lake level of the Great Salt Lake.
And of course, the weather obviously is going to play a big role going through April and May. I remember last year we had record amounts of snow and snowpack, but yet there was some nervousness about how the melt unfolds, right? If it was important that the melt occur, I don't want to say in a proper way, but not all at once, right? Because some years you'll get suddenly, we'll have a week-long spell of sunny and really warm weather, and the melt just kind of explodes. So obviously you can't predict, can't see too far ahead in that sense, but that's that can kind of foul up conditions. You know, you have great conditions right now, but if it doesn't melt well, there's impacts associated with that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, sorry to interrupt. I'm very optimistic that we'll get a nice return on this winter's snowpack. You're absolutely right. Last winter was a fascinating case. We had just amazing amount of snow come down in March. Mm-hmm. And then April, actually, last winter, underperformed. April was a below normal snowpack month last year. Mm. And so that's part of why we didn't see flooding, really widespread flooding, I should say. There, of course, were some local issues to deal with. But we didn't see widespread flooding last spring because of the very slow and kind of stair-steppy melt pattern that we had. It could have been, as you said, particularly in certain areas, it could have been a pretty major concern, and it came off the mountain slowly, but not too slowly. And so that's, we're looking at the same math this year, but not as much, because of course our snowpack isn't quite as extreme. But if we have snowpack that comes off too slowly, then we lose a larger percentage of it. What we like to see is the stream channels and the areas right next to the stream channels be essentially saturated, so that they act like a nice conduit, moving that water downstream to our reservoirs. But not too quickly. We don't want it to all come off right away, like you said, because then we just got too much flooding. So there's kind of a sweet spot in the middle there that we hope to hit. And last year, it nailed it.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll use that as a tease to have you back in a month or so to give us an update on how things are melting and how we're doing that. Jordan Clayton, Utah Snow Survey Supervisor, as always, thanks for joining us. Website, real quick.
Yeah, if you just go to your favorite search engine and type in Utah Snow Survey, you should get to the right page.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Jordan, as always, thanks so much for joining us on This Green Earth.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
All right. Let's take a break for an underwriter or two. When we come back, we'll speak with Lowell Bear. He's the author of the new book, Earth's Emergency Room, Saving Species as the Planet and Politics Get Hotter. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. And joining us for the second part of the show is Lowell Bear. He is an author, attorney, environmental historian, and the author of many books, including his new book, Earth's Emergency Room, Saving Species as the Planet and Politics Get Hotter. Lowell Bear, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Hello.
Hi, Lowell. Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us on This Green Earth.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, this is Claire and Chris Cherniak, and we have a couple questions for you about your new writings. We understand that you are just releasing a new book.
Yes, it's my sixth book.
Ah, okay. And this one seems to focus on the Endangered Species Act of 1973. So I thought...
That's correct.
Let's talk about the kind of the quote-unquote landscape, the American landscape, back in the 50s and 60s prior to the Endangered Species Act. What would you say were the conditions of our American ecosystems back then?
Well, the general population in America was becoming quite concerned about the extinction rate that was going on throughout the country.
Mm-hmm.
The National Wildlife Federation had actually been promoting recognition of the of several of the species, and the striped cats of Africa, the elephants here in this country, the condor, the whooping crane, which became a real symbol for the National Wildlife Federation, a promotion of the recognition of extinction in this country. And those were just a couple, three examples of what was going on. There was a lot of press, a lot of talk. People were focused on this in the media, and it got the public's attention. And that's really how it all started. And led up to several acts. The first Endangered Species Act was in 1966, which was more of an aspirational policy law than anything else. Then in 69, they amended it to include foreign species. And then in 73, those two were then incorporated in the major law, which we recognize today as the 1973 Endangered Species Act, which had some had serious teeth in it and encompassed all of the endangered species, not only of our country, but of foreign nature as well. But it was a period of what was called the Green Revolution following World War II that really got it started in the late 50s. In the 60s, it really became a recognized event going on with a conservation group that was formulating as a distinct population segment focused on nature and endangered species. And during that period, the Endangered Species Act of 1973 was really, really a high point, the sort of the culmination of a number of laws. The National Environmental Act was passed during that period, otherwise known as NEPA, N-E-P-A,
right.
Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and the Wilderness Act were all generated during that period.
And these would have had to been kind of bipartisan legislation under both Democratic and Republican presidents and administrations.
That's exactly correct. As a matter of fact, the Endangered Species Act passed unanimously in the Senate and in the House on the second vote. There were two votes. Both times it passed unanimously in the Senate. In the House, the final vote there were only four dissenting votes, but it was basically unanimous in both houses. And it was bipartisan. We were in a bipartisan period we could learn a lot from today. The Congress could learn a lot from today if they paid attention to the way business was done back then.
Right.
Very, very bipartisan.
Right. I mean, obviously, the Environmental Protection Agency itself was formed or established under the Nixon administration. Of
1970.
Course, that's right. There was,
and along with that, the White House added a department under the umbrella of the White House and actually on the White House campus called the Council on Environmental Quality, CEQ.
So, yeah, okay. It was universally supported, but we're not seeing quite that same landscape now. What shifted? Hmm. What happened?
Oh, golly.
big question.
Well, no, it's a long story, but
yeah.
There was a lawsuit, the very first lawsuit to challenge the ESA finally got to the Supreme Court in 1978. And it was TVA versus Hill. And it was over a little tiny fish called the snail darter.
Right.
It was going to become extinct when a particular dam that was under construction as part of the Tennessee Valley Authority system was completed. It was about 95% completed when the act was passed. And then thereafter, the snail darter was put up for petition and declared on the verge of extinction. And if they finished that dam and closed the gates and flooded a big landscape behind those gates, they would kill off the balance of the snail darters then. And that woke the country up, because the country thought that the Endangered Species Act was really to protect the megafauna that we have in this country. And by megafauna, I'm talking about the polar bears, the whales, and that sort of thing. And they realized through TVAV Hill that, my golly, it protected every species, plants, animals, insects, and so forth, that became listed and declared either threatened or endangered by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And that began to turn the tide against the Endangered Species Act by many, many landowners, primarily in the West, foresters, loggers, farmers, miners, and so forth, because they were all concerned that the areas that they were working in and the habitat that they were affecting could fall under the guise of the Endangered Species Act, and they would be breaking the law. So it really alarmed industrial America.
Yeah, I remember.
Thereafter, a mythology, what I call a dark mythology, was formed about the ESA, which still haunts it to today by many, many old-timers in the West that remember the early days.
Right.
And the enforcement of the act then is different than it is today, totally different.
I can see that it's one thing to be out and saving iconic species like you allude to, like the whooping crane or the grizzly bear, or I think it was the American alligator or so, and manatees and Florida panthers and such. But it was another thing to hold up a dam and hold up progress, economic growth and progress, because of a small fish, or like you say, a plant or a butterfly or so. They all fell under the rubric or the auspices of the Endangered Species Act.
They did, provided they were a biological assessment was done by that species, by the scientists of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And if they were declared, if they determined that they were in crisis and they were either threatened with extinction or on the verge of extinction, they were then what we call listed as either a threatened or an endangered species.
So how did that case unwind, Tennessee Valley Authority versus the I think you said Hill, with respect to the
Hill.
Snail darter?
Hill.
Yeah. What happened?
Yeah. Well, the Supreme Court said, look, this is an absolute law. There is no room for us as a court to overrule the findings of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, period. And we have to abide by their findings. They are the expert agency that was designated in the law to make the biological and scientific decisions based upon which their findings are founded. And they said that then in that case, and Justice Berger wrote the opinion, a good opinion that I've read many, many times. And he went on in that case to say that this did affect not just the snail darter, but all species that are listed as threatened or endangered and in crisis. And there is no wiggle room. The law was written such that it was an absolute top-down mandatory decision and enforcement by the federal government.
So going forward then, if politicians or big business wants to make changes to the law, they have to use the Congress to change the law in some fashion, or maybe there's some executive decisions that can be made by the executive branch, the White House or so. Do I have that right?
No.
Okay.
The only person who can change that law is the Congress. The White House does not have any say in its enforcement or its continued viability.
Okay.
However, you raise an interesting point. There have been only four amendments to the Endangered Species Act. The last one was in 1988.
Wow.
And the reason there had been no other amendments is because once you put a bill on the floor and begin its way through Congress, it opens the endangered species up to a variety of different other amendments and changes, which the conservation community has stood solidly behind as no changes, period, because it would open it up and weaken it. In the last, I'm searching, but there have been 605 attempts in the last 25 years to either repeal or dumb down the Endangered Species Act and make it far weaker than it is today and not as absolute.
Hmm.
In the current Congress, there are over 50 current bills right now that attempt to do the same thing. Hmm. The way that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been able to deal with changes in the country, given climate change, given the acceleration of endangered species being recognized as in crisis, et cetera, is to deal with changes through regulation. When the act was passed back in 1973, the regulations the law was 20 pages long, and the regulations were only 50 pages.
Mm-hmm.
Today, that law is 50 pages long, but the regulations are 5,000 pages long.
Ah.
And that's how, with changing conditions in climate and in the way commerce and business is operating today on the landscape, has forced the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to come to a variety of tools that they've added to the Endangered Species Act to make it more flexible and function better for the country.
So, yeah, beyond all this paperwork, when we talk about costs or money associated with this, what are the costs in securing the future of these animals?
The amount of money allocated every year by the appropriations process in Congress given to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to deal with endangered species, it's somewhere between 25 and 30 million just on the face of what the appropriations are annually. But there are millions beyond that are generated, which are used for species in crisis across the country by the states that come through the 1935 Pittman-Robertson Act, which last year alone, 23 numbers are not out, but in 22, there was $2.1 billion that was distributed to the states, much of which went towards species in crisis. It's a general fund that is used for a variety of different conservation efforts of different nature, but a lot of it falls into the dealing with endangered species. And then on top of that, you've got all of the NGOs that work towards species in crisis. And by NGOs, I'm talking about, for example, Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, the Wild Sheep Foundation, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, and others. I could just keep going on. Audubon. They all put money towards species in crisis, and nobody has ever really been able to figure out exactly how many million a year are spent through their from their resources as well.
Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Lo Bear. He is an attorney, environmental historian, and author of the new book, Earth's Emergency Room, Saving Species as the Planet and Politics Get Hotter. Lo, I want to talk a little more about the species in crisis, but let's go back and talk about some of the successes associated with the Endangered Species Act. Again, I think you alluded to a few. Whooping cranes were once endangered, not so much anymore. The California condor has recovered in population or so. Give us some examples of other species that benefited from the ESA.
Oh, golly, there have been many. Yeah. Let me just go back to the snail darter as an example.
Yeah.
Before the dam, what happened was Congress, through its mechanics and so forth, put a rider on an appropriations bill that overrode the Supreme Court's decision.
Hmm.
And Congress said, finish the dam, which was like 116 million, finish the dam, close the gates, and move on. So they did. Before that happened, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service went in and netted a ton of the snail darters and moved them into other surrounding creeks that were in that immediate area. And those have generated the continuation of that particular species. And believe it or not, that species now has been delisted. It was delisted last year.
Hmm.
And the man that moved to delist it is the very man that moved to list it back in 1975. He was a professor, law professor out there in that country, and he filed a petition to list that snail darter, and now through repropagation efforts in adjacent streams, it's come back.
Wow.
And there's a resilient species that has now been delisted.
Right.
But to specifically answer your questions, other success stories, the condor is one. It is still listed, just like the whooping crane is still listed, but it's well on the way to recovery. The black-footed ferret is still listed, but it's well on the way to recovery. It was actually lost. The small little group that was discovered in the Dakotas died off in the 60s, and then they were rediscovered over in Wyoming in the 70s. And they have been repropagated through the work of Fish and Wildlife Service. They started with the state of Wyoming in their repropagation center, and they were then moved to a place in northern Colorado. Mm. And it's been a real success story. They are still listed, but the population numbers are just phenomenal today. And that's from an original brood stock of about 50.
Wow.
And to understand and to care, you have to have an education. I remember when I was a child, we had a board game called the endangered species.
Oh.
And you could actually play, and I remember the picture of the condor because I never wanted to get that card because it wasn't as attractive as some of the other ones on the endangered species, but I can pull that up in my head. So when you're doing your writing and you're trying to educate us about the Endangered Species Act and what's happening, I'm curious of how you got to that title of the book, Earth's Emergency Room.
Well, thank you. That's a good question because, in effect, that's what the Endangered Species Act is. When a species goes into crisis, they are moved into, they are listed and moved into to a recovery program that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the biologists in the various states establish for that species. And they are then under the care and watchful eye, scientific eye, of the states and the federal government to regenerate the population and restore it to a what we call a viable population where it will continue on its own. That's a long process for many, many of our species. But in that period that they are in the recovery period and under the supervision of the states and the federal government, that is, in effect, an emergency room. And that's why we call it Earth's Emergency Room. That's why the book is named that.
Last minute or so, one species that's critical out here, out west, is the grizzly. And I believe there are some efforts to delist the grizzly bear off the ESA. Do you have any information or updates on what's going on with respect to the grizzly bear?
Well, I do know that it is being revisited by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I doubt that it will be delisted, even though the population has become what's called by the scientists a viable population in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem area. And it's being reintroduced in the Cascades over in Washington. Its future is really, really undetermined. It's somewhat like the wolves. Mm. Wolves have been delisted, relisted. It's been a real circus to watch that particular species go in and out of protection. And now it is out of protection and is actually being hunted in the three states, Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho. The bear, however, is still under scientific review, and there's a serious dialogue going on between the hunters, the sporting community, and the conservation community over its future. I doubt that seriously it will be delisted anytime soon, because even though its population has recovered in the greater Yellowstone area, there are many other areas that the bear used to populate where it's now been hunted out.
Right.
They're called the historic habitat areas.
Well, the name of the book, again, is Earth's Emergency Room, Saving Species as the Planet and Politics Get Hotter. The author is Lowell Bear. Lowell, do you have a website that people can go to learn more about yourself and your writings?
Thank you for asking that question. We created a special website about 2.5 years ago in order to further educate the public on the Endangered Species Act. It is called, if everybody has a pen,
yes,
it's called ESA, initials, ESA Act, A-T, not the little circular with an A, but actually the word
at
50.com. So it's ESA at 50.com.
All right.
Because it's celebrating that anniversary.
50 years.
50 years this last fall. So we are going to stay optimistic, Lowell. We appreciate you being on our show.
Yes.
and sharing a little bit more about the history of the ASA. And hopefully our listeners and we can get a little bit more involved and keep turning the tides to optimism.
Yes, thank you so much, Lowell, for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Hope so. And I hope the public will take advantage of the website and educate themselves about the potential risks that mankind faces as our species die out.
Right.
Absolutely.
All right. We'll leave it at that. We'll thank you again, Lowell, for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Have a good. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.